Persigo Press presents the Henry Rios Mysteries podcast. Hello, this is Michael Nava, author of a series of crime novels featuring Henry Rios, a gay Mexican-American criminal defense lawyer, and the producer of this podcast. Today we present Lay Your Sleeping Head, the first novel in the series. Lay Your Sleeping Head opens in the summer of 1982 in the fictional town of Linden, California, 30 miles south of San Francisco. Linden is the home of the prestigious university of the same name, founded in the 19th century by railroad tycoon Grover Linden. Henry Rios is a public defender, born and raised in a small town in California's Central Valley and from a working-class Mexican-American family. He is a graduate of Linden University and its top-ranked law school. In 1982, there is no internet. People smoke in bars and on airplanes. Most gay men are closeted, and no one has heard of AIDS. It's an America where 83% of the people identify as white, 85% as Christian, and 83% say that homosexuality is morally wrong. Ronald Wilson Reagan, who once declared that trees cause more pollution than automobiles, is the president of the United States. In this episode, Rios's questions about Hugh Paris's death provoke unexpected responses.
Remember the first time? I begged you. Please, it hurts. Stop. But you didn't stop. Later, I realized it was because that excited you. You wanted to hurt me. You wanted me to cry, to beg. After that, I refused to give you that twisted pleasure you took in hurting me. I kept it all inside and let you fuck me without a word, without a sound, even when you made me bleed. How did no one notice my bloody underwear, the blood on the sheets? Did you pay off the maid? And my grandmother, she knew, didn't she? After a while, she could barely stand to look at me, like it was my fault. Did she look at Jeremy that way? Because you did it to him too, didn't you? Isn't that why he hated you so much? Is that why you killed him? Yes, I know about that. You killed them both. Pretty soon, everyone will know what you are. Rapist. Murderer. Psychopath.
That was the last letter Hugh had written to his grandfather. I imagined Hugh's terror and hopelessness as he lay in the dark, listening for his grandfather's footsteps, knowing there was nowhere to go and no one to help him. No one to help him then. But now he had me on his side, and I wasn't going to stop until I got him the justice he deserved. I'd gone through all the files that Hugh believed proved his grandfather was a murderer. There was a CHP report about the fatal car accident that had killed Christina Smith Paris and Jeremy Paris, Hugh's grandmother and uncle. The CHP said Jeremy Paris was heading east on Interstate 80 a few days before Thanksgiving. The road was icy and it was getting dark. Just south of Tahoe, he lost control of his car, skidded off the road, and slammed into a tree. Christina was already dead when the paramedics arrived. Jeremy died at the scene. A witness named Warren Hansen, who had been behind Jeremy's car, said that just before the accident, another car came out of nowhere and banged into the side of Jeremy's car. The report noted Hansen was HBD, cop talk for had been drinking. So, apparently, the cops didn't believe him. The report concluded that Jeremy had been driving too fast on the icy roads and lost control of his car. Hugh's papers also included the wills of his grandmother and uncle. Christina's will split her estate between her two sons, Jeremy and Nicholas. Jeremy's will left everything to Hugh. I didn't see what Hugh thought the wills had to do with the accident until I realized that Christina hadn't left anything to her husband. Maybe that was what got Hugh's attention. He thought she had disinherited the judge, but the judge would have got their community property. She might have figured that was enough. If Warren Hansen was believable, and Jeremy had been run off the freeway, this might be a case of road rage. But murder? I couldn't see it. And there was nothing to connect Judge Paris. I picked up the last document, a journal Hugh had started in rehab, and flipped through the pages. One page caught my eye. A list of names beneath the heading that read, Step 8, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. The first name was Grant Hancock, the guy he told me he owed an apology to, the guy he had had dinner with the night he was killed, and very possibly, except for whoever killed him, the last person who had seen Hugh alive.
Hello, this is Grant Hancock.
Mr. Hancock, my name is Henry Rios. I'm a friend of Hugh Paris.
I see. Is Hugh okay?
I'm sorry. I thought you knew.
Knew what?
I'm very sorry to have to tell you, but Hugh is dead.
Hugh's dead? What did you say your name was?
Henry Rios.
I'm gonna have to call you back. Give me your number.
555-586-9472.
Thank you. I'll be in touch.
Hello?
Yes, it's Grant Hancock. How did you know Hugh, Mr. Rios?
We were involved.
You're the boyfriend. The lawyer in Linden.
Yes.
I see. I'm sorry for your loss. How can I help you?
You may have been one of the last people who saw Hugh alive. I just have a few questions about how he seemed to you. Will you talk to me?
Sure, but not over the phone. Can you come up to the city tonight?
Yes.
My place at 9? Here's the address.
Grant Hancock lived in a high-rise near the Embarcadero Center. There were no other residential buildings around, only deserted offices, shuttered stores, and a sketchy-looking, poorly lit park. I parked on the street and approached the blue awning that marked the entrance of the building. The doorman let me in and sent me to the 14th floor, where, after I rang the bell, Grant Hancock opened the door. The broad-shouldered boy in Hugh's picture had become a broad-shouldered man. Beneath a mop of dark brown hair, he had a square-jawed, sensible face and a big, athletic body. He was wearing a navy blue suit trousers and a white dress shirt. Put him in a pair of dark-framed glasses and you had Clark Kent.
Mr. Rios, come in.
Thanks. Call me Henry.
Grant. Have a seat. Can I get you something to drink?
Whatever you're having.
Here you go. It's a red from my dad's vineyard. Don't think you have to drink it out of politeness if you don't like it.
It's fine. I'm sorry to have to be the one to tell you about Hugh.
You caught me off guard, so I called his Uncle John. He told me it was true. He said it was an overdose.
According to the coroner.
When I saw him, he said he was off drugs.
He was.
I don't understand. He didn't die from an overdose?
Yes, but there may be more to it. That's what I'm trying to find out. If I could just ask you a couple of questions.
Sure. You want to make sense of it. I would too in your position. What can I tell you?
At dinner, was he high?
That's direct. He seemed completely lucid. He didn't even drink.
What did you talk about?
It was a private conversation.
Hugh kept a journal at the rehab in New York where he got clean. He wrote down a list of people he thought he had hurt and owed an apology to. Your name was at top of the list. Here, I brought the journal with me. See for yourself.
His handwriting never changed. Not from when he was 14. You read this?
I did.
He didn't write down why he wanted to apologize to me.
No. But he told me once it was for something that happened in prep school.
What else did Hugh tell you about me?
Only that you were a decent guy who had tried to protect him when he was a kid. And that he had done something bad to you and was still carrying around that guilt. Is that what you talked about at dinner?
Look, it's obvious that you cared about Hugh.
I did. Very much.
Then maybe it's better that you not know what he did to me.
I know Hugh had screwed up. But he told me he was trying to change his life, and I believed him. Anything you can tell me may also be relevant to some questions I have about his death.
Okay. But you were warned. He was 14 when he showed up at my prep school. I was 16. My dad's a friend of his Uncle John, and he asked me to keep an eye on him. I kept an eye on him, all right. Both eyes, in fact. I couldn't take my eyes off him. I fell in love with him. I knew I was gay, but I was deep in the closet, and until I met Hugh, I'd been able to maintain my cover. I had a girlfriend, I was captain of the lacrosse team, I was going to be a lawyer like my dad. There was no room in my plans for being a faggot. But Hugh, there was something about him. Not just his looks, but his, what, vulnerability? I don't know how to describe it exactly, but he was this beautiful, fragile creature. That golden skin, those blue eyes, that sadness. I wanted to take care of him.
I know the feeling.
Do you? Of course. I didn't tell him how I felt, even though there were moments when it seemed like he knew. Like he was waiting for me to make a move, wanted me to. But I wasn't sure if that was real or I was imagining it, so I kept my hands to myself. Then he found drugs.
How did that happen?
There's a bad crowd at every high school, even in the backwoods of Massachusetts. Kids went down to New York or Boston for the weekend and came back with a whole pharmacy. Pot, pills, hash, cocaine, heroin, you name it. I don't know when he started using, but he was hardcore from the get-go. I covered for him at first, but eventually I got so worried he might hurt himself that I told him if he didn't straighten out, I'd tell his uncle.
What did he do?
One night he came over to my dorm after lights out, crawled naked into my bed, and told me he loved me and let me... Well, he let me do all the things to him I'd been fantasizing about for months. we finished and he was lying in my arms. He said if I told his uncle about the drugs, he would have to leave school and we wouldn't be able to be together.
You kept covering for him?
Yes. I thought now that we were, well, whatever we were, I could persuade him to give up the drugs and the scumbags he was getting them from. I was in love with Hugh, but he wasn't in love with me. He loved drugs. He bribed me with sex to keep me quiet, then he started using heroin. That was it. I was afraid he was going to kill himself. I told him if he didn't stop, I would tell his uncle, even if it meant him leaving school.
Did you?
No. He said that unless I kept my mouth shut, he'd tell the headmaster I'd raped him. Talk about being sucker punched. Then it got worse.
How?
I was terrified of being exposed as gay, much less being accused of raping a younger boy. Hugh figured that out and blackmailed me for money to buy drugs. I wish I could say I stood up to him, but I folded. It went on for a year until I graduated and beat the crap out of him.
You what?
The day I got my diploma, I excused myself from my parents and went and found Hugh. He was getting high with some of his low-life friends. I told him I needed to talk to him. I took him to the woods behind the school and left him on the ground crying. I told him, now you can tell the headmaster anything you want, asshole. That was the last I saw or heard from him until a month ago when he called me up and asked me to have dinner with him.
How did that go?
It was very awkward. He said he'd been in some kind of drug program, and part of it was making restitution to people he had hurt when he was using. He wanted to give me money to make up for the money he had blackmailed from me. I wouldn't take it. I told him the money was the least of what he had done to me. He said he knew that. He told me, I took advantage of the feelings you had for me, and I'm not asking for you to forgive me. I'm just letting you know that I know what I did and how wrong it was. So, long answer to your question, that's what we talked about. I warned you that you wouldn't like what I had to say.
That Hugh used sex and blackmail to support his habit? He was an addict.
He was 15.
Meaning?
That's pretty hardcore behavior for a kid, don't you think? I always wondered if there was more that was wrong with him than the drugs. Whether the drugs were a symptom for something deeper.
Did he tell you his grandfather raped them when he was 10 years old?
Judge Paris?
Yes.
No. And if he had, I wouldn't have believed him. I clerked for Judge Paris. He's an arrogant jerk, but a pedophile? No way. Did he tell you his grandfather raped him?
Among other things.
Just like he was going to tell the headmaster I raped him. See a pattern?
That was different. He wanted something from you.
Oh, maybe he wanted something from you, too.
What would that be?
Your sympathy? To keep you hooked.
You're still angry at him.
Yes, I am. I'm not saying it's fair. And I'm sure it's not very attractive since he's gone, but when I came out to him, I let him in on my deepest secret, and he used it against me in a way that drove me back into the closet for years.
Did you tell him that?
Yes. He said he was sorry. Sorry doesn't always cut it. I must sound like a jerk.
No. You seem like a stand-up guy, and what Hugh did to you was unconscionable. You're within your rights not to forgive him, but I think I knew a different Hugh than you did.
He did die of an overdose. Maybe he hadn't changed as much as you wanted to think he had?
I have a couple of more questions, and I'll be on my way. When you had dinner with Hugh, did he say anything to you about the car accident that killed his grandmother and uncle?
No.
Did you see him leave the restaurant?
I walked him to his car.
Notice any damage to his car? Broken taillight, crack in the windshield?
No, not that I saw. Why are you asking me these questions?
There are some circumstances about his death that don't add up to accidental overdose.
If it wasn't an accident, then what was it?
I think it's possible he was murdered.
Murdered? Who would... Wait. Are you suggesting Judge Paris had something to do with this? That's crazy.
Thanks for your time, Grant.
Henry, wait. I didn't mean to offend you. You seem like a stand-up guy, too, so from one stand-up guy to another, think about what you're doing here and who you're doing it for.
What does that mean?
I get it about Hugh. I really do. When he walked into the restaurant and sat down across the table from me for a minute, I was a love-struck 16-year-old again who would have done anything for him. He had a kind of golden glow that sucked you in, and even though he wasn't directing it at me, I still felt it after all those years. I can only imagine what it was like for you when he was turning it on full tilt.
You're saying he used me? That he's still using me?
I don't think Hugh knew any other way except to use people. Not because he was a bad person, but to protect himself and to get what he needed. Whether it was heroin or love. All I'm saying is that whatever it was he needed from you, he doesn't need it anymore.
You think I don't know who Hugh was? He told me who he was. A liar, a thief, a whore. He warned me not to trust him. He told me he still wanted to use. He told me every morning he woke up, he had to decide whether he wanted to live. He wasn't keeping anything back from me. I knew he could have gone back to junk at any time, but I don't believe that's what happened to him this time. I believe someone stuck that needle into his arm, gave him a hot shot, and killed him. And I'm going to find out who that was. Here, keep Hugh's journal. Read it. Then tell me I'm wrong about him. Tell me he wasn't trying to change.
I guess you did love him. Yeah. I'll read his journal. Maybe reading it will help me forgive him. Let's keep in touch. Let me write my number down on my card.
Thanks.
If it's any consolation, it was pretty clear to me that he loved you too.
Thank you. Good night.
Hey, mister.
Yeah. What the?
Get him in the car.
Hey, let me go.
Drive.
You've been listening to Lay Your Sleeping Head, a Henry Rios mystery. If you enjoyed this podcast, please spread the word on social media. We depend upon your support to keep this series going. For updates and behind-the-scene extras, visit us at our Facebook page, The Henry Rios Mysteries, or at michaelnavawriter.com under the podcast tab. We'd also love to hear from you. Message us on Facebook or email us at persigopress@gmail.com. That's persigopress@gmail.com. This is an abridged version of the novel, Lay Your Sleeping Head. You can buy the complete novel at Amazon. For this episode, our cast was Armando Rey as Henry Rios, Douglas Georgas as Grant Hancock, and Sean Gerbo as the assailant. Our director is Russell Kaltschmidt. Our sound engineer is Dave Peck. Music and sound effects were composed by Josh DeRosa. This episode was written and produced by Michael Nava. Thank you for listening.